Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. The first thing I would like to do today is to make a correction to my previous podcast on America's demographic winter and the census results for last year. I had said that 3/4 of the counties in the United States had natural decrease, that is, more deaths than births. It was actually 2/3 of all counties in the United States. I put that in there from memory. I should have put it in my notes, but that's the correct figure. 2/3 of all counties. Still pretty bad, but a little bit better, perhaps, than I had let on in the last one. Speaking of demographics, I also saw some Twitter conversation this week about cities and the importance of church in the cities and where people are moving and the urbanization of the country and the world. And one of the stats that you hear is that the United States is 80% urban. And the fact that America is 80% urban is 100% true. The Census Bureau classifies the United States as an 80% urban country. And in fact, this is a stat that I use all of the time. However, when you use it, you need to caveat it a bit to explain what is really meant by 80% urban. For one thing, the Census Bureau defines as urban any town with more than 2,500 people in it. So if you live in a town of 3,000 people, 100 miles from the nearest airport, congratulations, you're urban. That's not what most of us think when it comes to being an urban resident. And the Census Bureau actually distinguishes between what they call urbanized areas, which are urban centers of 50,000 people or more and their surrounding areas, in urban clusters, which are those below that. And so if you remove the urban clusters, all these smaller places below the 50,000 person threshold, keep in mind, 50,000 is not a lot of people. That's kind of a small city. Nevertheless, if you cut out just the urban clusters, that reduces America to more like 70% urban. But more importantly is that the definition of urban includes suburbia. All suburban areas are classified as urban. We tend to think and distinguish between urban and suburban, between downtown and the sprawly subdivisions on the fringe. But from a demographic standpoint, those are both urban. They're just different forms of urbanization. One is maybe a 19th century form or early 20th century form. The other is a post-war form, but they're both urban. And so when we say that America is an 80% urban country or that other nations are very, very high percentage urban, what we have to understand is that that figure may not totally conjure up in our minds the reality of the situation on the ground. The fact is, relatively few people live in traditional, dense, mixed-use, walkable cities in the United States. A stat that I like to use, and this is in a Governing magazine article I recently wrote about this in it, is that if you combine the populations of New York City, LA, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, the District of Columbia, and Seattle, you get something like 20 million people. I don't remember the exact amount, and you'd have to add it up from the latest census. But if you just add up these central city areas, not the whole regions, just the central city areas, you only get about 20 million people. And yes, there are limited amounts of urban areas, even here in Indianapolis or in college towns. But the truth is, if you took the whole genuine urban experience in America and added it up, it's just not that huge, because most of the growth in the country occurred in the automobile era. And so it is built around an automobile form that is mostly suburbia. So when people talk about the number of people living in cities and the fact that America is 80% urban, you have to really understand what that means. It's mostly talking about suburbia, and it's also talking about a lot of very small towns that the Census Bureau classifies as urban. Again, those smaller towns, the urban clusters, they're only about 30 million people. They're not a huge sum, but it's worth thinking about. So I just throw that out there. After my last podcast on a demographic winter, I got a suggestion from a reader basically saying, hey, Aaron, you should incorporate more of your old urban policy work into this podcast. And so let me know if that's something you'd be interested in. You know, some of these educations on the demographics and some of the trends in society, I do want to do some of it because these trends are very important in understanding the world that we live in. If you don't understand what's happening demographically, if you don't understand what's happening economically, then just knowing the culture, you're missing some important dimensions of the puzzle in America. So we really have to do that. So I'm going to include some, but if this is the sort of thing you like or don't like, be sure to let me know. And again, if you have suggestions for topics that you would like me to cover in the podcast, please send them my way, aaron@aaronwren.com. And again, before we get into the meat of this week's episode, I want to encourage those of you who have not yet done so to leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Hit the like button or the subscribe button on YouTube if you listen there. Helps people find it, really helps with discoverability. I greatly appreciate it. And if you're only a podcast listener and are not yet on my free newsletter, please consider subscribing at aaronwren.substack.com. That's aaronrenn.substack.com. This week, I want to follow up a little bit on the census results and demographics and hone in just a little bit on immigration and one aspect of immigration that we don't think about a lot. Talked a little bit about immigration last week and the decline in immigration levels. And this is a big flashpoint debate in America between those who essentially want an open borders regime and those who would like to have a much, much more restrictionist environment. And sure, there are others who say you have to distinguish between legal immigration and illegal immigration. But I think by and large, you separate people into those who would like to have lots of immigration and those who would like to have a lot less immigration. And immigration is one of these things that I think we need to consider in terms of a lot of dualisms. For lack of a better term, I'll use the term dualisms. So what do I mean by dualisms? Chaos and order, yin and yang, hot and cold, liberal and conservative, maybe dynamism and change versus rootedness and preservation. These are things that we need to have both. They're things that need to be present in the proper balance, and the proper balance of them changes depending upon the circumstances in which we find ourselves. And this sort of dualistic thinking is not something that Christians normally use or talk about, not in my experience. Our dualisms tend to be more oppositions, like good versus evil. We don't want the proper mix of good and evil. We want all good and no evil. Or we think about something like the person of Christ, fully human, fully divine, and yet neither of them are mixed or adulterated. So it's not like he's a blend of human and divine. He is fully human, fully divine, and they don't mix with each other. Or at least that's my understanding of the theology. It's quite complicated. So we tend not to think that way. But I think this is something that we need to. And one of the appeals of a Jordan Peterson is that he explores the world through some of these lenses. I believe he talks about Genesis and the creation story through the lens of chaos and order and bringing order out of chaos. I haven't actually listened to that podcast that he did. But these are things that really intrigue people because they resonate with something. And there is a dimension of creation and the human experience that is related to these things. And so when it comes to demographics, we can think of these two principles again in terms of the dynamic principle or the change principle and the preservation principle or the rootedness principle. And we see these in conflicts all the time. It's not just immigration, it's also gentrification. And the reality is that you need to have both. You need to have a sense of rootedness to preserve your place in what it is, but you also need to have a certain amount of dynamism and change, or your place is going to eventually kind of collapse and go down the tubes as it fails to adapt to the new. And so you hear complaints in high growth cities, high growth neighborhoods, that there's too much change and it's displacing everything that's old. It's not just displacing the things that are old, it's displacing the people as well. So the people who lived there before are the people who are being displaced by gentrification, for example. There's a phrase they use with regards to Singapore, the Hotel Singapore, this feeling among Singaporeans that their country is just a hotel, that people come in, they stay a few years, they make their money, they get out. You hear a lot of talk in Austin, Texas, about how the city is losing its soul, about how, you know, all the music clubs can't afford to pay the rent anymore and they're going out of business. All of the uncomfortable parts of change that come with too much change, too much, too fast, that people cannot adapt to, or which changes something fundamental about a place that the people who live there don't like because they value what it is. They value what it was. They value the tradition and the continuity of that place. On the other hand, you can have excessively static populations, excessively static economies. Someone I know called Cleveland a cul-de-sac of globalization. And his idea there was not that globalization had destroyed Cleveland, but that globalization had bypassed Cleveland. And if you look at a lot of these Rust Belt cities, what you discover is they're very, very, very heavily populated by people who were born there, and there are relatively few newcomers in the city. And that causes a lot of challenges. One, it does mean that any newcomers who do come in often have trouble making friends. In places like St. Louis or Cincinnati or Cleveland, people who move there from out of town, even a place like Minneapolis, they often have trouble making friends because people have their friends they went to high school with or whatever, their social networks are established. It's much harder to penetrate the social network if you're not from there. What does that do? It makes it hard for employers to recruit and retain talent nationally, which ultimately undermines your economy. It's also calcifying of a place's culture. It makes change very difficult. So many of these places are economically depressed. A lot of leaders were like, we need to make some changes. We need to, you know, redesign some streets, for example, or we need to build a new YMCA downtown, or we need to try to do something to make changes. But every time you try that, there's a chunk of the population, maybe it's a quarter of the population, it's not a tiny amount, who viciously attacks you. Any change is just viciously, utterly attacked. And the political dynamics in these places favor those who prefer preservation and stasis over those who prefer change. And thus, it's very difficult for these places to adapt to changing times. So that's a problem. So I live in Indianapolis. We are a growing city. I think we are a welcoming city. We have been attracting people who aren't here, but most of them have come from within the state of Indiana and so are very culturally similar. I would argue that Indianapolis is a place that probably could use some more newcomers because newcomers are the natural constituency for the new. And if you need to make changes, if you want to kind of move forward, you need to try new things from time to time. And again, it's the newcomers who are not wedded to the old legacy ways of doing business and become the constituency for the new. And I would say when it comes to newcomers, it's mostly domestic newcomers, native-born newcomers, rather than immigrants who are likely to drive that change because in the first generation or two, immigrant communities usually aren't that politically involved. And to the extent that they're mobilizing for action, it's predominantly around their own community. They're building a cultural center for their local community. They're building institutions. They're, you know, networking, getting together. They're not trying to change the politics of the place. I think the reality is, if we move to a foreign country, let's say I move to France, am I going to start agitating in French politics, particularly if I'm not even a citizen? Probably not. It's just not my country. It's not my place. I'm kind of a guest there. And so immigrants tend not to be political agitators. Now, you would see plenty of immigrants and children of immigrants on MSNBC or whatever talking. That's a pretty narrow segment. Often the spokesmen for various groups are not at all representative of the people they purport to represent. And that's not just immigrant communities. I've said the same thing about the Republican Party. Republican elected officials, you know, movement conservative intellectuals do not represent the average Republican voter in the country. Their preferences of the leadership far, far out of step with what the base, what the electorate wants. So the people you see on TV are not necessarily reflective of communities. And so you need to have both the dynamic principle and the preservation principle and kind of the rootedness principle, but you need to have them in a mixture that depends on the place. In a place like Cleveland, they probably need more change. Maybe in a place like Austin, it would help if they had a little more of a slow down approach. I think the key is whether you want more change or more rootedness depends on the context of the situation. The right balance is not true for all. And by the way, this again applies to churches as well. I used the examples of the Anglican Church in North America last time. You can think about Catholic Church. There's cradle Catholics and there's converts. And in the ideal world, you want both. You need people who are cradle Catholics to really not just transmit sort of an intellectualized faith or the rituals of the faith, but really the embodiment of the faith, the culture of the faith in a particular place. But you also want to have newcomers as well because of the Great Commission. Whether you need more newcomers, right, or more kind of cradle Catholics is probably going to depend on the locality. There are places that don't have many converts. And so probably need to be making more converts. You know, there are those who are probably too many converts, could use a little more rootedness to keep their own congregations from becoming too culturally assimilated to the moment and miss out on some of the richness of the faith. So I think this is something that affects both. There's a dualism here. And this is where we get to immigration. And, you know, we've had waves of immigration in the past. So in the late 19th and early 20th century, we had an enormous wave of immigration. And then we turned off the tap and we went through a consolidation phase. And then up through about 1965, we have, turned open the taps again. And especially starting in the 80s and the 90s, there's been a massive acceleration of immigration into the country. And I think most people do not really appreciate the levels of immigration that have taken place in the United States. The last I checked, there were about 45 million foreign-born people in the United States. But that doesn't really capture the full picture. By the way, that's a fact that I'm, again, taking out of my memory, so look it up before you quote it. I think it was 43 million the last time I looked, but we should check on that. It changes every year. But this is one where it misstates it. The 80% urban statistic probably inflated things a little bit, gave you a false impression of a too urban place. The percentage of foreign-born populations sort of underestimates the impact of immigration because it doesn't count the U.S.-born children of those immigrants. And so if you really look at the people who have entered the country in the post-1965 immigration wave, it's probably somewhere between 80 and 100 million people, I'm guessing. And yes, some of those are probably third generation on down. Should you really call them, you know, at this point, they're maybe more assimilated. But this is like an enormous part of the country. And this is the reason why all the statistics that you hear around the United States is going to become a, you know, majority-minority country by 2040 or whenever. That's because of these enormous waves of immigration. In a couple of generations, America is essentially going from, you know, an 80% white country with, you know 12%, 12-13% black population, and a few other little minorities, to essentially majority-minority country. And so there have been enormous quantities of immigration into the United States. And, you know, historically, I would have been very much on the open border side of the equation. I would never have called myself an open borders guy, but kind of in my heart, I'm a guy to say, you know, the more the merrier. We got a great country, and the more people who we can share this great country with, consistent with keeping it, you know, a great country, is something that I'd be in favor of. But what we've seen certainly within the last few years is that many of the immigration critics were right. Immigration has dramatically destabilized the culture and politics of the United States. You cannot understand the political dynamics of the country without reference to immigration. And this is something that was also very key to Donald Trump. When he came down the escalator, he's talking about immigration. His catchphrase was, "What? I'm going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it." In the absence of mass immigration to the United States, Donald Trump would never have been elected president of the United States. So even those who are very pro-immigration and very anti-Trump should understand that immigration has profound social and cultural consequences as well. And I would say it's very clear that we've gone too far to the chaos side of the equation when it comes to immigration. In fact, if you just look at what's going on at the southern border right now, it literally fits the definition of chaos. We essentially don't have a southern border into the United States. And so we've pressed the pedal to the metal on the dynamic principle, and that, much like gentrification and displacements of these neighborhoods, much like the Hotel Singapore, we have now injected, in my view, too much dynamism into the system, and we need to have a consolidation phase in which this mass amount of people into the country have been, are more integrated into society, and we're able to deal with some of the cultural fractures and upheavals that we're seeing. And so that would be something there. I don't think there's a policy for immigration that is right at all times and in all places. It's one of these things that's a dualism. Do you need more new blood? Because you know what? We do need new blood. We can't just have completely insulated, isolated things. Or do we say, wait a minute, we're being overwhelmed with change that is ultimately destroying the very thing that we valued and that we were hoping to preserve and extend through dynamism? We're actually almost in a replacement of that with something completely new. And again, that's essentially a little bit what happened, in the early 20th century. We did sort of redefine America and what it was in order to assimilate that, and that worked out well. And I actually am of the opinion it could work out well again. But one reason it worked out well is because we had this consolidation phase that came after a period of restriction in which the immigrants were integrated into an America that was then essentially refactored into something positive that built out of that. And that's not to say that there were no negatives from that wave of immigration. There were. However, ultimately, that was a success in terms of being able to reintegrate it. But it would not have been a success if we just kept pushing the pedal to the metal forever. And I think we've taken in shares of immigrants comparable to that wave. And it's probably time for a consolidation phase. And again, we see this in cities as well. Great cities tend to go through boomtown phases, usually a 30-year boomtown phase, then you got to go through a consolidation phase. And if you can't manage the transition to a consolidation phase, or to put it in corporate speak, from being a growth company to being like an operating company, right? When you've run out of stores to open, when you can't open any more McDonald's because you have a McDonald's everywhere, you have to run your existing business. A lot of people can't do that. But if we can't manage those transitions, then we end up in maybe a place we don't want to be. And I would just go back to Ecclesiastes, which I think has very, very good thoughts on this. And so we read the famous passages from Ecclesiastes 3, 1 to 8. In fact, I'll just read it to you because I think it's a great passage. "There's a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace." And so What this shows is that the right policy in many, many domains of life, the right thing to do in the moment, is not always a constant. It varies by circumstances, and it requires wisdom to know. Is it a time for war, or is it a time for peace? It's not always obvious, but sometimes there is a time for war, and sometimes there is a time for peace, and we have to know which is which. Do you know what time it is? That's a question I would ask. And this affects not just immigration, but it affects so many matters of our time. Do you know what time it is? And when it comes to immigration, I think it's very clear that we've gone too far to the dynamic side and is now time to enter a consolidated phase through a significant reduction in immigration levels for a period of time, just as we did in the past, in order to successfully integrate previous waves. Something to think about, just a way to have a perspective on this and other issues. You may not land on the same point that I land on, but hopefully thinking about these principles, the idea of dualisms, and the idea of you have to know what time it is and what is the appropriate action for today, hopefully you will find that useful. So again, please send me your feedback, please send me your suggestions, and I will talk to you next week.